A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. I'm your host, Stu Whiffin, and joining me today is Matthew and Richard of Minty. Seminal art popsters, Minty. This was one when I got an opportunity to speak to them. I couldn't believe my luck. It was like I saw them support Pulp in the mid-90s, and then since then I've kind of gone down many rabbit holes looking at the genius that was Lee Bowery, which obviously we talk about in this podcast as well, as well as some of the seminal club nights that that Matthew has put on, and we go into it. And I mean, the actual conversation itself went on way, way longer than the conversation you're going to hear today, purely because of my open-mouthed wonder at just what an incredible promoter. Just fascinating stuff. And when we finished recording, we recorded this one in lockdown, by the way. Matthew was like, I think that was a bit too long. I'm gonna edit it. So I was like, okay. So I handed over the editing to the guest, and which was completely unique and never been done before. So thanks ever so much for editing the podcast yourself. Who's ever had a guest that's done that? And there's going to be an incredible mixtape put together by Minty to accompany this episode as well. So when you just keep an eye on the socials, because we'll be sharing that as well. Thanks ever so much, Richard and Matthew, for editing it and guesting, and you're in for a real treat with this, because what an insight into an exciting, weird and wonderful world of Minty. Before we get on with the episode, big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for, I guess, not editing, but just mastering and topping and tailing it with this intro that I'm doing now. If you like this and it's your first episode of listening to Off the Beaten Track podcast, go and have a look in the archives, because there's 120 or so episodes with some of your favourite musicians, actors, comedians, DJs, producers. Go and have a rummage in the archives and see what you can find. And there's also a Patreon page where we put a standalone episode up each week as well, so you can support the podcast by supporting that. Well, you can find out about everything at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Anyway, let's get back to business. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Minty. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fairwear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Hello and welcome to Off The Beaten Track podcast. And sitting opposite me today via the means of Skype from Old Compton Street. I've just been privy to a look out of the window. Joining me is Matthew and Richard of Minty. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah, good. I'm just saying that we're really enjoying 28 days later at the moment. There's the only zombies around are the police, though, so all the zombies are wearing fluorescents, so you know when they're coming at you.
So you find that it all right, the whole kind of lockdown?
I think that what's happening to our economy and our politics is very worrying. It's going to have severe fallout. I don't think we're being particularly well led through it, but apart from that, I'm enjoying the deserted streets from a cinematic point of view. What about you, Dickie?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it, but it's a bit the sky's fallen in. What's going to happen in the future? You know,
Richard's very interested always in what's going to happen to the aesthetic, as far as what's the cultural meaning.
I mean, yeah, club music must be dead for a couple of years, I'd have thought.
Which I disagree with completely. I think the one thing that kids are not going to be doing is keeping distance. I imagine we're going to see youngsters crammed in like sardines, jumping up and down.
I think it's really... I think what we're going to get from this lockdown is, I think you're going to get some incredible stuff where some creatives are going to be creating some absolute magic, but you're also going to get people, I think we'll look back and there'll be some amazing stuff come out of this. I think there'll also be a lot of shit as well. I think a lot of people will start making stuff, and
there's a lot of shit already.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
The only limit to it is how much storage space Google has. You know, Google seem to be the general silo of the planet, so there's always room for another layer of shit at Google headquarters.
Well, I always start this podcast with the song with the greatest intro, and this is quite unique as well, because this is only the second time I think I've ever done an episode with more than one guest. It's nice to have two. The last time I done that was just before Christmas with Nitzareb, and so
love them. One of my, I was even going to put Joining the Chant down as one of my.
Oh,
my,
really?
But I just thought, no, I can't. I was thinking about the club track, and I just thought, no, it's too. It was sweet listening to it again. I mean, I love them and I love it, and, you know, of course.
So, Matthew, do you want to tell me your song choice first, please?
The one I chose was the Hugo Montenegro MacArthur Park. It is instrumental and very swinging 60s and what we would call doo-doo lady. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Being the Pearl and Dean advertising soundtrack from, I don't know what years Pearl and Dean used it from, and it seemed to go on forever, like up until the late 80s. I seem to remember it. So I love it, as it's very symbolic of the sound that we went into after Acid House. We may come back to this, but I did a club called Smashing that started in 91. I started this club in 91 with Martin Green, the DJ Martin Green. Because around about 1990, everyone thought, oh, God, you know, no one's going to be listening to house music in 2 years. Because, of course, we come from a generation, as do you, where musical fashion and style and aesthetic, well, cultural aesthetic, changed every 3 year max. So, of course, we'd all been dancing to house music since, really, 86, 87. And although we could see it was growing, it was just getting boring. People were doing the same thing over and over again, and it was getting what we, of course, in those days, we would have called naff. We were all always very much from the school of big character. We'd come out of the 80s hierarchy, and house music, the most refreshing thing about house music had been the democratisation of social life, and the democratisation of the dance floor in many ways, where those 80s hierarchies had been broken down. And so the character of early acid house had been so much about rebellion and a fight for your right to party, but because of the Criminal Justice Act and the clampdown on the orbital parties, as soon as it moved into the growth of the kind of official rave scene, you know, it's getting a bit old hat. So we moved much more into this period of kind of beatniky, rare, groovy.
Would this have been around the time of Eddie doing Blue Note? And
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was the Blue Note. So, I mean, there, that scene, that Hoxton-y scene was developing. But there was this in-betweeny beatnik scene. So it was where the psychedelic end of acid house then crossed back over into the kind of, into 60s-y, you know.
Yeah.
And it was very good fun, and we all grew goatees and smoked lots of pot and wore dark glasses and wore caftans. And it still kind of interfaced with the more psychedelic end of the house scene, but we were moving away from that. And I got to know Martin Green and had really loved his music. And he'd made us a mixtape that we were playing constantly to get ready to go out. And it was a very eclectic mix of soundtracks and Stoogesy kind of stuff, some ELO and Bollywoody kind of disco stuff. Just all sorts of great tracks, really, from the history of music. And so that Hugo Montenegro was on that mixtape. And I just loved the memory of the Pearl and Dean theme and that being the intro to every great film that I'd ever seen. And so it became one of the smashing anthems really early on, because the whole atmosphere of the club was also kind of, you know, poking the balloon of nightclub pomposity. So the whole club was set up to be the uncoolest club in London. So we would play themes from Black Beauty and all gallop around the dance floor. It was at Maximus, which held 800 people, and we'd only get like 100 people in. But the guy who ran it was so great. He always gave us free champagne. And I mean, there's lots of stories about smashing, but it was set up as to be this very anti-cool club. And of course, you know, as these things go, 5 years later, there were queues around the block of celebrities wearing sunglasses, at which point I closed it.
That is a wonderful answer. Richard?
I'm stuck after that. I just chose my track, Breakaway, by... I've forgotten his name, Steve. Have you got it written down there? I can't remember who it's by.
I have. One moment. It is by Steve Carman.
Oh, yeah. I just chose it because it's like 2 long minutes of anticipation build for about a 30-second bit of song within the end. So it's all intro, I think, building excitement, anticipation. And so...
I'm interested to know, as musicians and as, you know, as DJs, how you approach when you make music. Like, how much emphasis do you think there should be on an intro? And like, is it? I mean, as a DJ, you know, intro can be everything, but necessarily, you know, there's edits that are made purely for DJs with, you know, huge intros to let you mix them and things like that.
4 bars max.
Of course.
No, unless there's a theatrical intro. And a theatrical intro is fine. Right. You know, a big flourish into something. But fuck that. If a DJ can't cut, drop, in, don't play it.
So how important, how much emphasis, you know, and this talked me into, how much emphasis was put on, was radio a consideration? When we're talking about sort of pop music...
I don't. Richard may have a different answer. I think, you know, was it to you, to me, or I will just say, nothing is ever a consideration apart from what I like. That's it. As far as I'm concerned, as an artist, I do it purely to please myself. And I think any artist who tries to please anybody else in whatever genre is on a hiding to nothing.
No, I think the opposite. Yeah. I think you have to... I've heard so many singers that say that, and I want a pop song, really, and that means it has to communicate to somebody. So that I think you should have the audience close to you, the people around you. You should entertain them. And if you can do that, then it might spread.
So I've run about 10 clubs, six of which have been notable for one reason or another. And they all are very different in genre. Everything from 20th century classical music all the way through to industrial noisecore and, you know, electro to rock. And Richard has been the DJ at nearly all of them. Because so Richard and I, although we disagree on almost everything, seem to agree on almost everything as soon as we shut our mouths and just play the music. And yeah. So some of the clubs have been successful and some of the clubs haven't been successful. The most unsuccessful with the population was Harder, Faster, Louder. But to me was the most successful artistically. To me, it's my favourite club. I don't care if people came. I liked it being empty. It was just a wall of noise. It was difficult. It was painful and damaging to people to come to. It was designed to be both painful and damaging, and physically and emotionally and mentally.
So what was the driving force to do that, Matthew? Like to create something that you are aware is going to be unpleasant for people.
Well, it's like, why do people go on a roller coaster? It's unpleasant, but it's also exhilarating. It was designed as a fairground ride, really.
People were locked in.
People were locked in. Yeah, they're dicky. So what do you think about Harder, Faster, Louder? I never asked.
Yeah, I loved it too, especially when we had roller skates, Harder, Faster, Louder. That was good. It was so dangerous.
So you liked it. It's got to be the favourite thing we ever did. It was the most extreme. So, but that wasn't designed around people liking it.
No, but there was a scene with Alec Empire and DHR Records round the corner. A lot of people were into this Harder, Faster music, weren't they?
There was a scene. It dovetailed with the death metal scene and the hard industrial end of jungle. I mean, it was really the Prodigy that came out of... It was that Prodigy production sound which really came out of that. Atari Teenage Riot had been on tour, had been supporting Prodigy. We thought we were on the cusp of a new pop music, which was just kind of chiselled out of a granite wall rather than notes being projected into silence. The approach was much more for a sculpture, chiselling shape out of a solid wall of noise.
But also with the lots of people like Mr. Ed that were making, though we weren't getting the music through commercial channels, we were knowing lots of the people that were making the
lots
music.
Of music came in by cassette. We had people from all over the place sending your music on cassette,
so it was kind of
popular,
responding to each
it was
other.
Niche. I think niche should be the word for it. But it was funny because it was the first thing I did after Smashing. So Smashing had turned into the Britpop, Brit Art VIP room of London by this point, whether it was Damien Hirst and Tracey Emin or the Oasis Boys and Damon, and Madonna would turn up and demand a VIP room and we'd all laugh at her and throw her out. And it got to that point. But by this point, the audience were used to me just going up and slagging them off on the microphone. And I went up and I just said, you know, I want a steamroller. I wish I could drive a steamroller through this club. And I came on stage and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Ooh, I may have something for you." And played me. I think it was an Alec Empire track. And I was sold. I was just like, yeah, got it. Fine. Shut it. Get rid of all the pop stars and all the celebrities out. Get all of the filth, the industrial hardcore filth from the death metal scene and the really hard industrial jungle scene and the noise skull. You know, the noise artists were different to them. And so there was, but it was a niche. But of course, on the opening night, the press and the celebs all came because I'd shut this big successful club, and everyone thought it was insane. And I opened my new club. Of course, it was the new place to be. They had to be in by midnight, else they weren't coming in. So everyone was excited and in by midnight. And
we did an hour's piece of music for people to come into.
You could only enter between 11 and 12. The doors were only open for an hour. And when you walked in, it was completely silent with all of the house lights on, with people kind of sweeping up and going around going, shh. It was completely silent. And all the house lights were on. And it was in this place called The Office, wasn't it? It was great. We found this venue that had just been done up, and it was like a lifestyle place. And so the bar was one huge slab of concrete. It was a bunker. We couldn't have found anywhere better. They had just discovered polished concrete. We managed to get all the furniture out. And so there was nowhere to sit. There was no ashtrays. So everyone was kind of turning up in their glad rags and thinking, you know, what's going on? I was nowhere to be seen. There was no music on. People were sweeping up, and there were people milling around on rollerblades and roller skates. It was a roller disco as well, of course. But it was free with wheels. So people came with BMX bikes and Tesco trolleys, and it was down the stairs, so people had to bump whatever vehicle they had down these stairs into this club. And the venue let us do it. It was amazing, the venue let us do it. But then every week there was a build-up. We called it the sound ramp. We would commission a sound artist each week to do a build-up from zero to nosebleed over a half an hour period, a sound sculpture. And so as this would unfold, the lights would begin to dim very, very, very slowly, and with the rumbling. So usually we'd always want the subsonics. Well, the first week, this changed in subsequent weeks, but on the opening night, it was packed, of course, because everyone was there to for my new celebrity nightclub. And all the bar was packed with drinks. We didn't know this was going to happen. But as the rumble began, all the drinks started moving down the bar, smashing, until there was this huge pile of glass at the end of the bar. And then as these subsonic frequencies built up, the bloody optics started popping out from behind the bar. The bowls were coming, falling off the shelves, and everything was on the move. It was a theatrical touch we hadn't planned. And then it would build up and build up and build up until people were shouting over it, and it would just be a and then build, by which point it would be pitch black and lights would be starting to flash and the noise would just be becoming really oppressive and then physically painful. And then I'd come out with a megaphone, right, that's it, that's fucking it, go, 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 and this hardcore drum and bass would kick in, and all of these kind of grungy kids suddenly exploded into this mad frenzy, and all the fashion people were pinned against the wall, terrified, screaming. And on all the flyers it said, wear earplugs and wear protective clothing, because the skaters would start circling. It became like rollerball. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
The skaters would start circling on the dance floor. It was this fucking concrete bunker. And they do the old sticky tag thing. They'll make a line. And so the people at the end would be going at like 30 miles an hour. And then they'd let them go and people would go shooting off down the bar. Oh, it was hilarious. It was brilliant.
That sounds fucking incredible.
And of course, all of the fashion pack also didn't realise that at midnight, just as this sound got beyond funny, we came out and locked all of the doors, locked everyone in, so no one could get out. And of course, it was all based on totalitarian imagery, as all good industrial events are.
You know, it's funny the time Andrew insisted on bringing a motorbike.
Well, there was that was what blew my ears, was playing the motorbike, where we mic'd up a motorbike. The venue hadn't pointed out either that actually carbon monoxide poisoning in a basement with the motorbike being revved up. And I couldn't work out why everyone was going woozy and falling over, including me. So it was just... It was wonderful, wasn't it, Dickie?
Yeah.
It truly wonderful. But not popular. Not what you call popular.
Okay.
Sorry, that was a completely off point.
Oh, it's the best thing about podcasts is when they just pinball everywhere. Track two... the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you?
That was when Mary Poppins came out, when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And it got to the end, and then when it went into Let's Fly a Kite, I just cried and cried for like 2 or 3 hours afterwards, because Mary Poppins was going away and I was supposed to be happy at flying a kite. And it was, just seemed so tragically
deserted for the first time, Dick. You were deserted by Mary Poppins.
I was only about four or five, but...
What do you think the emotion was?
That she's come into their lives to make... Probably the dad was a bit off. He's into his work and wasn't really family man, a bit like my dad. And she sort of brought the family together magically and then disappeared up into the sky. And then they're sort of happy, but not magical. It was the losing the magic, I guess.
Happy, sad.
That you could just fly a kite and be happy with that when you could have had Mary Poppins. I just cried and cried. All the way home in the car, I remember.
Did you feel deserted?
Home. Yeah, maybe.
But that's for children,
and
young children.
And not being satisfied with
just
flying a kite.
You wanted more.
Yeah, when you could have all the magic bags and things.
You were just upset because you didn't have any showbiz, or that you just had a bloody kite. I want a bloody kite for my birthday.
Brilliant. And Matthew, what was yours?
Mine is Marianne Faithfull as Tears Go By. My dad used to play the Rolling Stones version in his Aston Martin as we drove to Wales. My dad was a trendy interior designer in the 60s. I was almost going to say Slade, because my dad designed Slade's interior, the studio, and... He'd play the music at home, and my mother used to hate it, but I loved it. I found it so exciting, especially that track, Are You Ready Now? Are You Ready Now? So Noddy was also kind of around at that time and would pick me up and swing me round, which of course I thought was marvellous, and my mother thought was very below us. My dad and Noddy Holder go out and get completely hammered. There was that whole period of, like, I don't know, the late 60s to the mid 70s where everyone just seemed to be pissed. I don't know what it was, but that whole kind of world was just soaked in booze. Everyone just drank like fish. I mean, my dad wrote off like six cars, completely pissed. It was normal to go and write off a car, darling, you know. Everyone was roaring around, completely and utterly drunk, all the time. And so we bought a house in Hay-on-Wye, on the borders of England and Wales, which is now where the Hay Literary Festival is. And... we would drive up, and we were slowly kind of moving there, kind of to base ourselves there when I was about four. And As Tears Go By was one of the songs that would come on in the car. We used to play the Rolling Stones version of it. But Marianne Faithfull was one of the other people that was around Hay-on-Wye. And a handful of kind of celebrity types, but Marianne Faithfull was definitely one of them, used to come around to our house... And they'd all get pissed. And the men would all go in one area and the women would all gather in another area and drink and drink and drink. And I remember this scene with Marianne Faithfull going completely crazy. She'd obviously heard the Rolling Stones version and was furious that my mother was playing that and not her version, which afterwards was all we ever played was her version. So it was a big to-do. The song itself I find very beautiful. The song itself touched me emotionally. I remember looking out of the window driving up to Wales and it being winter and having a deep, deep sadness of being old, older than I am now, of looking back and completely understanding it as a young child and completely feeling like I was at the end of my life looking back over... At the time, you know, the sadness of looking back at a life. But I remember being weirdly displaced into like an elderly consciousness. And that having a huge resonance on me. There was the drama. I mean, the funny story is obviously the kind of Marianne Faithfull drama. But actually the real emotional connection was this deep sense of having been here before and knowing what it was like to regret a life. Seeing myself as a child on the swing, but also seeing myself as a very elderly person, looking at a child playing and encapsulating both consciousnesses simultaneously. It was very, very odd. It was like an out-of-body experience, really.
Wow.
And the drama was just a plus.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Well, I guess we can move it forward a couple of years now. For track three, I'll ask you both the song that reminds you of your time at school.
You go.
I put Cherry Vanilla because a bunch of friends from school went to see her. She was famous as an Andy Warhol, part of the factory scene, and we were just really excited to see someone part of Andy Warhol's factory. And her backing, when we went to see the gig, the backing band were the Police, and we thought they were a bit rubbish. And we spoke to the masters because they were milling around and said, "Can we get backstage to meet Cherry Vanilla?" And they were very nice, and they took us backstage to meet Cherry Vanilla, and they stayed chatting to us, and they had their single, which they were selling on 7-inch vinyl, so we bought it off them because they were so nice and chatty, and that Stuart Copeland took our pictures. And so I'm surprised Cherry Vanilla didn't really please eclipse her, really, but I love her expressive voice on that record, Foxy Bitch.
How old would you have been then?
16 or 17. So actually, just left school, but it was with school friends. We went to see the gig.
Did you enjoy school?
No, I hated it.
Why's that?
It was too alienating and big. It was a big comprehensive with... And I was from a little village previously with a little school, which I really liked. So we moved to this... It was too... You felt lost in a bigger environment. You couldn't make a...
Sure. I get that. Matthew?
What song did I put down? There was a load of them.
You put...
Eighth Day by Hazel O'Connor. Oh, my God. Bam, 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 bam. He just got upset. I went to five or six schools. I can't even remember. I think I've lost count. I got deported from most of them. I loved primary school. Like you, I was in a small Welsh village, of course. Then I went to Hereford Cathedral School, which is near Hale Moy, which is a boarding school, and studied music.
What did you want to be?
A pianist, or in show business. Hey.
Was you a confident kid at school?
Kind of, yeah.
Was you a show-off?
Yeah, I was. I got in trouble, and I left that school. I played the theme from Star Wars on the cathedral organ and got into all sorts of trouble. And I was in trouble anyway, because I'd been telling lots of fibs, and I was doing all sorts of occult shenanigans. I was very Harry Potter. My whole thing was, you know, the world of levitation and seances and Ouija boards, you know, that whole 70s obsession. What was that whole thing with levitation? Do you remember it with your fingers?
Yeah, of course, you put your fingers there.
Picking people up with FS. So that whole world, I was in the world of Ouija at that time, and, you know, obsessed with the Bermuda Triangle, etc.
Kids don't do that anymore. It was a rite of passage, that Ouija board thing, for me and all my mates. It was like when you got to secondary school, it was like, right, we're going to do a Ouija board, ram your mates ass, and it doesn't seem to happen anymore.
I think everyone's been brought up on. I think they must do, because there's all of those ghost adventure programs and they did the Ouija board and letter. I mean, it's so much a part of Charmed, those kinds of TV shows and film. You know, all shows, they've all got bloody demons crawling out the Ouija board these days, haven't they?
I know. We need to find out if there's a Ouija board app. That's where the money is. Do a Ouija board app.
schools, at a church school, so they weren't best pleased when I discovered the idea of the Black Mass. I cottoned onto Satanism at quite an early age and thought, oh, this looks like it'll piss off the rector. So I was turfed out. And I ended up in a big comprehensive like you did, I went from one to another and couldn't settle. Obviously, my mother sent me to my first day at comprehensive dressed in my school's rowing colours. My previous school's rowing colours. I've never been to a comprehensive school before.
How did that work out for you?
Well, you know, I was I certainly received a thorough beating. and that was my second year of school. And so that beating carried on for the full first term, really, from going to school to Christmas. I went to two or three different comprehensives, which, you know, I was pretty... I mean, all the confidence that I had previously been showing in directing black masses and dancing around the dormitories in hooded capes, all of a sudden was kind of knocked out of me very quickly, which it does tend to be. And it was very... It was really traumatic, actually. And then... Dad had to come back to London to work. Dad had gone to work in Wales, but that hadn't worked out. And as the oil crisis hit, we lost everything. So I then went, you know, then I grew up like everyone else, pretty much in poverty. Dad was back in London. And so to get rid of us, he would give us money and send us down the King's Road. And I stumbled upon the Great Gear Market for the first time and saw punk freaks. And Neuromantics. So this is about 1980-ish, 1980-81, and heard the music. I think I heard Divine. Divine was going to be one of my tracks as well, but it all just kind of mushes up into one big euphoric explosion of disco beats, hairspray, hair dye, the smell of Barry M makeup. Mixed with patchouli oil, because somehow those kind of punky psychedelic people were still around. There was somehow the kind of hippie thing was dragging on as an undercurrent through all of this grey blusher and concrete. And it was a very, but it was such a heady mix. I remember walking to the Great Gear Market and just thinking, oh, I'm home. This is it. And I went to, around the same time, I went to the cinema and I on either King's Road or in Piccadilly. And I managed to see Hazel O'Connor, Breaking Glass. It changed my life. It completely changed my life. And for the first time, I saw a story of somebody getting to build a community. Find a community through their music, through their art, through their self-expression, with outfits, with hair and makeup, with this wonderful music, which I absolutely loved. And there was the scene at the Music Machine in that became the Camden Palace, and Philip Salon, and I'm pretty sure Mike Nichols and a few other people that I now know were in this scene sitting on the stairs. And I was just like, I have to know those people. I have to know those people. And I went on to know them all. The £5 I was meant to spend on badges at the Great Gear Market, I spent at the hairdressers at the end, and they laughed at me when I... Even in those days, having a decent hairdo was like 30 or 40 quid, which just seemed like incredible. Like...
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But they gave me this kind of fuzzy pink mohawk, and I seem to remember that I was still wearing flared jeans with a brown body warmer and wide-necked 70s shirt with a pink mohawk that I just brand new from the Great Gear Market. Well,
That's quite a combo.
Talk about one foot in each era. And my mother opened the door, fainted, just went bang, fainted. I mean, she hated Noddy Holder, what can you say? So she went bang, she was straight on the floor. They couldn't touch me. They were just literally stood there screaming, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, pointing and screaming. And I found that, and we had moved to North Devon, so I was actually, it's really weird, I'd ended up, after being in school in Hereford, my mum had had to get a job because we were so broke. She could only get a job in North Devon. We'd moved to North Devon. And this is where I was getting dragged around all these comprehensive schools, being beaten up in schools in North Devon. And I walked in, I went back to school after the holidays with this pink Mohican, by which point I'd managed to find myself a black T-shirt and some black trousers, which I also wasn't school uniform. And this Invasion of the Body Snatchers just seemed to carry on as I walked to school. People were stopping and screeching in their cars and pointing and screaming. As I walked through the school gates, everyone turned around and pointed and screamed. As I went into the classroom, everyone pointed and laughed and screamed. But nobody hit me. Not one person hit me. And I thought, oh, you like this hairdo? Wait for my next one. And of course, the hair got bigger, the makeup got bolder. Then of course I discovered Susie, and you know, the Susie eyebrows went on. I was to the point where I was getting up at 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning to get, it'd take me 4 hours to get ready for the catwalk into school. Just, you know, the reactions got more and more. I was suspended. I had the police come round to tell me to dye my hair. The social workers. I mean, it was just, I mean, the whole thing was just exploded into this ongoing social drama of my hair and makeup. The whole world seemed to revolve around what my next look was going to be and how outrageous and disgraceful and disgusting, and it was marvellous. I just thought, this, I can't, it was so, of course, you know, every day was a new look just to see how so much I could wind them up. So breaking glass was really the trigger to that. The eighth day was such a, and it's just the drama of it, the theatricality, the quasi-classical nature of it, Hazel's voice. I just, you know, I love, I've since got to know her a little bit, but before Susie, it was Hazel. She was my girl crush. And then it was Susie, and nobody ever came close after that.
Well, I guess looking at your selections for the next track, it's probably in and around that time. And so for track 4, I asked what the first song you remember buying from a record shop was.
I mean, it's not really the first one, but it's the first major journey to a record shop to get the record. I mean, the first one I probably bought was Alvin Stardust, My Cuckoo, or something when I was 14. But when I was 16, 17, I heard this record shop had Buzzcock Spiral Scratch in stock. And it was a huge, I just remember the huge journey to get on several buses to get to Andy's record shop in Cambridge to buy the Spiral Scratch EP, then all the way home again, another hour's journey on the bus back home. Because I wasn't at home when I found out, I was at someone's house, and it was like several bus journeys away. And
how
so,
did you know about it, though?
I don't know. Maybe I rang.
I was going to ask that exact question.
I don't know, but I did find out. I was at someone's house near Huntingdon, and I found out. Maybe I rang the record company and said, the record shop, and said, "Have you got this in stock?"
But how did you know? Did you heard it on John Peel?
No, I hadn't heard the record. I was just waiting for it to come out. So
you can't remember.
Maybe my friend had said, "Oh, I saw it in that shop." anyway, it took a, it was just a huge journey to get it.
What year was it?
Probably 77 or 76, I can't remember. And I was thrilled when I played it. It delivered everything. I was worth the journey. But it wasn't really the first record I got, but it was the first big journey to get a record.
It's funny because that whole punk thing, because I'm slightly younger, I'm like a disco generation younger than Dick. So a disco generation is about 5 years. So I remember at boarding school somebody coming with a Sex Pistols album. And I just thought it was a bit tasteless. I didn't find it exciting at all. I found it tasteless.
A sudden new idea was sweeping the land.
But I suppose it must be when it coincides with hormonal release.
Completely.
The experience I had of Hazel O'Connor was, you know, must have it just happened to be that's what coincided with that release of puberty or that massive rush.
So, looking at sort of 76, 77, Spiral Scratch, and you saying the difference, you know, being 5 years between years, that...
Might be a bit more.
Like that. But I guess your choice, Matthew, was one of the most, I guess, exciting records of that time, your first record you bought.
Fade to Grey. I was almost hesitant to put it down because it's almost such a cliche, because it's so iconic, certainly to our generation. But you can imagine me doing looks, going to school. I just kind of discovered the dress-up thing. I discovered the post-punk new wave. I was in it. I was in it in my own mind. I was in it in North Devon in my own mind, and, you know, dressing up. Seeing Steve, I mean... That was it. I had to have that record. That was everything. Not only was it about the record, who I wanted to be. When I saw Steve and I saw the video, of course, the video blew me away because it was one of the first, after Ashes to Ashes, which I also really loved. Ashes to Ashes had a huge impact on me, but I didn't rush out and buy the record.
Because Steve's in the video to that, isn't he?
Steve's in the video. Ashes to Ashes gave me the feeling of being nauseous with excitement, but there was something about the look that looked too much like a costume. I loved the sound of it, I loved the production, I found it thrilling, and I loved the video style and the looks. It touched me, but as soon as I saw Fade to Grey, my head was spinning. I was doing an exorcist moment. I was so excited. It was like I released every fluid in my body simultaneously and ran to the record store.
Whereabouts? Where did you buy it?
Barnstable, North Devon. And I remember some, like, rocker people in there kind of looking down their noses at me. And I remember taking it and turning around to them and just... I'd have had some crimped number going on my head. And just turning around to them and holding it to my chest and turning my nose up and just looking witheringly at them. I am ice. all at once I was at the Blitz. By this point, like many of us at that time, if there's a guitar anywhere near it, it's out. OUT. I used to like OMD when I first heard the OMD stuff, then I saw that one of them had a guitar. I was like, ugh, vile. But to me, it was a premonition. It was about, I'm going to be a club promoter. It was more than just, I love the makeup, I love the sound, I love the synthesizers, I love everything about it. I love the way it is pissing people off in society. I love absolutely everything about it. But this is also my entire career.
And was it pissing off?
The skinheads in town didn't like the fact that I had blue hair, jelly boots, and matching blue lipstick and eyeshadow. The punks didn't like it. And the mods didn't like it. You remember how tribal, but certainly in small towns it was so tribal. Don't pretend you didn't know how tribal it was. You're a fashion designer.
I don't...
You went to Vivian Westwood?
In London it didn't
in London.
Seem,
no, it wasn't in London, I was in fucking Barnstable.
Yeah, in London it wasn't. I mean, nothing was as tribal between the characters at Blitz, like Steve Strange and Boy George and the
So, well, this is where it gets interesting. So, of course, I'm clutching my Steve Strange to my heart. You're there, in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Working for Vivian Westwood, cutting patterns for Vivian, knowing Malcolm. So, yeah, tell me what you're saying, that George and Steve and everyone were all at each other's throats.
The competition and the ruthless one-upmanship. I mean, put any little tiffs between skinheads and from New Romantics to the shade, I think.
I mean, I went hunting Steve Strange. I was on a Steve Strange hunt from that moment.
I think it's amazingly clever lyric for someone who was promoting themselves as Dress Up and getting all this press for Dress Up, and to then to say we'd fade to grey.
Yeah.
It just seemed, I still think, wow, how did you come up with that idea for that lyric? To counter
the
image.
Midge sing it? Isn't it Midge's voice?
I'm not sure. There was all sorts of stuff, isn't there? Because I think that, you know, Rusty had a thing to say about it all as well, didn't he? I'm not too...
I don't really know Rusty very well. I recently spoke to Rusty and I liked his new music he was making. But I went to the Camden Palace and being turned away because I obviously looked about 12. And I was crying on the pavement outside, and this big dame in kind of New Romantic-y powdered wig and hoop skirt turns up and did Old Fairy Godmother and put me under the hoop skirt and smuggled me in. In I went. My first nightclub, scurrying under a crinoline.
Wonderful.
And then I got inside and met Frank Egan, legendary figure of the underground South London squat scene. They had a group called Radical Drag.
Yeah.
And they would go out in bad drag, beards and lipstick and wonky wig, when you would get killed. They were going out to start fights and would go into really heavy reggae clubs in the middle of the day in Brixton. So that was kind of their thing, was frontline brawling in the daytime piss in Brixton in drag. Anyway, that gives you an idea of the kind of people. So I met this one of the leaders of the pack, this creature with this wonky wig and ill-fitting dress. He's like, who's the child? And I was going, oh, is Steve here? I just want to meet Steve. Took his fag out of his mouth, put it on the floor, stare at him. You don't want to meet her. You don't want to meet her. I said, please. Okay, if she wants to meet Steve, let her meet Steve. And this Frank Egan one took me by the hand, dragged me up to one of the boxes in the Camden Palace, went barging in, and then Steve in really a cowboy look, which I was like, why is he wearing a cowboy hat?
It's not Clint Eastwood period.
But it was cowboy fancy dress. I mean, anybody who knows anything knows that when you do a look, it was war. It was aesthetic war. You took your life in your hands when you went out. I couldn't put disappointment with this experience. I was like, oh my God, I'm disappointed in the outfit. And he came up to me and was trying to kiss me. Of course, I was, you know, young. So I was just, this thing's now kind of leering at me with a sweaty face and a cowboy hat. And Frank Egan then steps in and goes, you fucking touch her. I'll fucking smack you, you old cunt. These two fishwives now hammering at it. My entire world is crumbling. And Frank just grabs me and goes, told you didn't want to meet her. And like, dragged me out. And I was like, what happened? I don't understand. What's wrong with him? Ah, Coke, girl. And I just thought, how much Coca-Cola must he have drunk? And I didn't touch it for like 10 years. How much Coca-Cola must it take to lose your style?
Well, I guess while we're talking Coco and Camden Palais and Clubland, track 5, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
I guess it's Love Attack by Ferrara for me, which just represents the most exciting... It came out in like 78 or 79, I think, before clubs were really... But it still retained the excitement of what I want to hear from going out to a club, something that really, wow, I've got to go. It just thrilled me each time I heard it.
It marks that moment, doesn't it, where discos turned into nightclubs. Because the punk scene wasn't really, it wasn't clubs, was it? It was much more gig venues.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was that moment, I mean, there was the Bowie night at Billy's. Was that, that was before
Blitz? 78, yeah. Before Blitz, before Steve Strange did Blitz.
And so, but Studio 54 in America was still seen as a disco.
Yeah.
Because the night, what we knew as nightclubs kind of started within the bodies of the dead disco.
Hmm.
I don't understand the difference between nightclubs and dead disco.
Okay, to me, there was the whole period of the discotheque with disco music.
Saturday Night Fever.
Saturday Night Fever. And it was those bodies that we inhabited as nightclubs. So to me, there was always a difference between a disco, a party, and a nightclub. The nightclub is much more exclusive. It's like a stamp club or a... You don't get train spotters at a stamp club. It's made for people who are into anaesthetic. What would the venue, disco venue, be at the time?
Sombrero in Kensington High Street.
The Blitz wasn't like going down to the Sombrero in Kensington High Street. It didn't have a strict aesthetic.
No.
So, but that's the difference between a nightclub. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So your track, Love Attack, really symbolises that shift of nighttime music between disco, because it's still very disco, it's still got the four beat, but that exciting, energised, darker synth sound is coming forward. And it was that electronic sound that led the nightclub.
I mean, I suppose I Feel Love did the same thing, but... And that came out in 77, middle of punk, and it sort of stops you dead thinking, wow, that is something...
Yeah.
To watch out for. But then Love Attack really hasn't lost its power for me, which I Feel Love maybe has.
And so, Matthew, your song's come a few years later.
I only chose that because I couldn't. I mean, it's just impossible.
Yeah.
I did 25, nearly 30 years as a promoter. And from every club, there's a classic. Well, what's that you've got there?
I thought I'd get some brandy.
Brandy?
Wonderful.
Oh, I haven't had a drink in weeks. Thank you, darling.
Lovely. Cheers. So what are you, because you sent me two over. You sent me LFO
Smash It With A brick.
And yeah. So really those two tracks were tracks, the LFO track and Hit It With A Brick. To me, it's what is nightclub attitude. You know, it's cod. Minty actually means cod. So Minty was gay slang for being off. Yeah, snooty. Oh, she's a bit minty. And what's important to say about them is neither of them are 4-beat. I only point this out because it was like the tribal battles between the punks and the goths and the rockers and the mods. For me, there was a tribal battle between house music and then what became Britpop or grunge. So house music, to me, was really a vehicle out of the 80s, hierarchy, so the very strict social hierarchy.
Yeah.
And so I loved it. I adored the democratization of it. I adored the fact that those people didn't get it. The people that had run the 80s club scene weren't involved. I remember going to Shoom with George, Boy George, and Lee Bowery. George took Lee and I there, and Lee was in full face sequins, and I was in a prosthetic lipstick. I was about 7.5, 8 feet tall with a huge prosthetic lipstick growing out of my head, a big rough platform boots. Lee was in beautiful hand sequined Michael Clarke look. Boy George was in his Boy George outfit.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. On the door, Jenny Ramplin went, £5 each. And George went, how dare you? Don't you know who we are? Don't you know? I know exactly who you are. £5 each. And Lee grabbed me by the hand and went, George will pay. And kind of dragged me in. But we got into Shoom, and I remember it being quite low ceiling area of Shoom. And we were all crammed in these ridiculous huge outfits with smoke and this flashing strobe light. And all these kids dancing around with basically tracky bottoms on, those horrible lilac tracksuit bottoms. I loved the music, and I loved the atmosphere. And I just looked at me and Lee and George just stood there.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
They're looking like fish out of water, and I just thought, it's over. It's over. We're done. It's finished. It's through. And I went home and I just threw everything, all my makeup down the loo. Oh, so house music really emancipated me. And at that moment, I also started directing pop videos for a lot of the house acts. So it gave me huge opportunities and a huge sense of freedom and wonder. And then by the time people started taking E and coming up to you, oh, like a golem, they were like golem, gurney golems. I love you. I love you. And I go, fuck off, I don't even know you. I took it once in my life. Fortunately, it didn't go with my metabolism at all. So I could observe what it was doing. And anger was always so important to me. This opposition to society, whether politically, aesthetically, emotionally, the opposition to the mainstream, had always been so fundamental to my view of myself and the world and what I was doing. And by that point, the world of nightclubs, which was central. It was my chosen medium as an artist. I saw myself as an artist, and the nightclub was in fact a medium. And I just grew to loathe the whole house music scene because I thought it was completely fake.
Yeah.
And I thought, I mean, I still think they put a record on in 1991. I said, I'm fucking taking it off. Oh, do you remember when we did the Lux? There's the kind of art space called the Lux, and we'd let off all those fireworks. And we'd done a show down there, like an industrial noise core show, and the finale was a load of outdoor fireworks set off inside. And so the whole place was full of smoke, and it was the fire alarms going off. And anyway, we got thrown out of there. And I was in some kind of utilitarian mini dress. So where can I get a drink? Trade. It must have been late. Went down there, and I had my megaphone, because I always used a megaphone with Hard of Fast Lad, and I was marching up and down the bar at Trade, kicking people's drinks on, going, Ein, zwei, drei, vier. Ein, zwei, drei, vier. Can't you faggers count more than four? We just come from this world of this wall of kind of avant-garde noise, and I was going, you fucking faggots, you can't count more than four. And kicking people's drinks into their faces. So, of course, I got dragged off the bar and beaten up and thrown out by the security. I was on a one-man mission to destroy house music. It didn't go very well, but I was so furious about its monotony and blandness and tiresomeness. So mintiness was something that kind of kept coming back. Even though when I thought that I had been saved from the horrible 80s attitude, it turned out it was actually running through me like Blackpool fucking rock.
Whilst we mention Minty, so this has been facilitated for Paula.
Pensioners on PR, that's what it's called.
so tell us what's happening in the world of Minty then.
We're relaunching Minty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who would have thought? We did it because it's 25 years. Lee died New Year's Eve 94-95. And so 25 years since losing the real leader of the pack. It was time. It was time to take stock. It was very painful to look back. That whole period of there were so many people were lost, through the 80s. People don't talk about it much. That period was traumatic as well. I mean, that's the other thing is that people forget, is that people were dropping dead around you. And when people talk about Taboo and what Taboo was as a nightclub and what the gang was, the bullying, the violence, but the death. This was on the fucking 9 o'clock news, this stuff. We were the celebrities that people gossiped about. When people say, oh, nightclub world, this strange, rarefied world. No, remember, Steve Strange got to me in North fucking Devon. The people I knew, then came to know in nightclubs, were huge international global pop stars and fashion designers and filmmakers and writers. The people who were at the clubs were international stars for a brief period, for about, you know, 8 years. London nightclub world was the fiery furnace at the centre of global aesthetics. And that's why I chose nightclubs as my art form, because I understood that with 200 people in a basement in London, you could change the world. And I learned that from Steve, and I learned that from Lee. It's really important when we're talking about this stuff to try and get some context, which is very often forgotten, which is it mattered. It was life and death. It mattered. We meant it. And we died, lots of us, putting our vision in place.
Track 6. A favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Devon's not really my home county, but I chose Muse. Just because I like that Muse track.
Yeah.
We can talk about the tension between electronic and rock music. Because at some point, at smashing, in the 90s, I discovered the guitar could make some interesting noises. I discovered that I loved powerful guitar. You know, I rediscovered Pink Floyd and great guitar bands. And you and Dix was playing the guitar, so then I found out that you were playing the guitar.
Well, I tried to... When I first moved to London in 78, I got a college grant, because they were giving grants those days, and I bought a Fender Stratocaster. But I just was hopeless at playing it, and I didn't really get round to learning it.
Yeah, you really improved.
Until I was 30. 30, I managed to get a whole song.
Your whole song?
When I started working with Louise, pray.
Richard was the house band. When we started smashing, you and Louise, you were in a band with Louise Prey, who was this kind of it girl who was like a model, and you became the house band, and you were playing the guitar. So everyone was kind of doing pub rock. So we kind of just all went into this kind of Bull and Pump style pub rock scene, because the fashionable people hated it, because they all thought, you know, the Jean-Paul Gaultier and people wanted to listen to all shushy house music. People were very angry that we were doing it because it was so naff, it was so wrong, it was just so wrong. But Lee came in the jigsaw. There's a Fergus Greer image of the black face with the big padded jigsaw headpiece and the jigsaw kind of dungarees. Huge as ever. And got me by the hands and was spinning me round on the floor of Maximus. And it was a really magical moment. And I was loved, of course. I was, you know, in awe of Lee. Lee was... Did you meet Lee?
No.
You very rarely do you meet a genius in any field. But Lee had the vibration of greatness. He was a star. So I'd always wanted to be engaged with him in some way. But you had wanted to start a band with him at Taboo, hadn't you?
We had started a band and we wrote 3 songs together in Taboo. Because we'd seen a lot of
What were
play.
The songs?
We did one called Young, Young and Silly, Hanging Out in the City. I can't remember the rest.
But who else was in the band? It was you.
Judy Blame.
Judy Blame. It was you, Lee Barridge.
And the fashion designer, John Richmond.
That's a super group.
We thought...
80s super group.
We'd just write some songs and it would just happen, like it did for Alana Pillay with I've Got a Pistol in My Pocket, Baby.
I used to come and sit where I'm sitting right now, and because when Lee had just started sitting for Lucian Freud, and so he'd be round here in the afternoon because he had to get to bed early because Lucian liked painting early in the morning, and so it was always the afternoons, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so I used to come around literally every afternoon. The launch of Smashing Live, the first ever Smashing Live, we were the first promoters in Madame Jojo's, which was a drag club, had been a club travesty, but they had a fantastic stage, and. So I came around and said, oh, yes, you're headlining. Your new band's headlining. It's Minty Band. You're headlining, Lee. And they went, what? We don't have any songs. And remember, you were going, oh, we don't. What are we going to play? And I said, well, you must have some. I said, well, it is a drag club, Lee. You can always mime like a drag queen, which, of course, has a red rag to a bull. And there was what are we going to do? And I said, well, you know, Smashing's a rock club, so it has to be a rock band. And Lee said, well, what do I know about rock music? And I said, well, you know, you'll find out tomorrow. Your bands will be waiting for you at 2 p.m. in Kensal Road. I'd already sorted, I'd got a band line, I'd got the drummer, bassist, rehearsal room, everything all lined up. I said, see you at 2 o'clock tomorrow and you'll find out. So that was our first big band gig. And it leaded with Sheila Tequila, Orville, do you remember?
Yeah. I wish I could fly.
I wish I could fly way up in the sky. That was in the set list, I think.
I wish I could fly, yeah.
Yes, Orville, I do. I wish I could fly too.
So is it because of 25 years you've decided to...
Yes, because it was 25 years since Lee died.
We've been trying for years to get a Lee album together.
We've got 5 unreleased Lee tracks that no one's ever heard. Good ones. And then a pile of half-finished bits and bobs. Because Lee used to sit around here, right here, and you and Lee
do freeform jams.
So we've got lots of jams. Really interesting jams. It's really interesting to hear. But it was all recorded on your Tascam.
Yeah.
And it was Trevor Jackson. I bought Trevor Jackson's Tascam.
Okay.
So after Lee died, we put together a large performance art group called The Offset and put together a kind of performance art collective. And we did these nights called the Mint Tea Rooms. And had anybody who wanted to explore making sound, really. Adento X came out of that. Adento X formed.
And Polystyrene.
Polystyrene was in it, yeah. All sorts of people came through it. And Aidan Shaw, the porn star. Sexton Ming, who's a poet. Really interesting people. Ron Athey, the body artist. But it was out of those rehearsals that the band kind of came back together, because we block booked this rehearsal time. So we thought, let's take a couple of hours and just kick around some ideas musically, with Nicola and me doing vocals, and it was great. There were some really great ideas. And I wanted to change the name. I said, if we're going to start a new band, at least change the name. We argue to this day, don't we, about that?
Wow.
We still argue quite aggressively about that to this day. I haven't got to the bottom of it in 25 years.
Because you joined because of Lee, because you...
Yes, yeah. And you.
Yeah.
And you.
And Lee had I'd call it postmodern ideology.
Well, but this is another fight. The legacy of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm. The last track is the track where I ask you to recommend a track that people may not know.
The Offset was very much this kind of gang show. We've got an Offset album, and this next track, London Broil, was the lead track. So I met this queen, the most miserable misanthropic person I'd ever met, who I just fell in love with because it was so miserable. And was making kind of Casio synth music on cassettes. And I just said, I really, really want to do something for you because you're so fabulously horrible. And we were talking, who's your favourite bands? And he said the Soft Cell, early Soft Cell had been, you know, really influential. And I was like, oh my God, me too. I said, I know Dave Ball. Let's do a track together with me, you and Dave. So we did, and that's my last track. It's called London Broil and Potatoes. That was going to be the first track on the Offset album that never came out, that we hope to release one day. But it then became the lead track on the Cashpoint album, which was released much later on. You know, many years later, we did Cashpoint as a club. And again, I wanted to make, and there were so many fabulous bands around Cashpoint, that I made this compilation album. So Doris was one of my absolute favourites from the Offset, who then became the lead track on the Cashpoint album. You haven't even heard it. It's a kind of bridge between the 80s, Cashpoint, and Harder, Faster, Louder, the Noise Core. And produced with Dave Ball.
I'd love to hear that.
Well, we'll send it over straight after.
That'd be great. And which was your tune? If you get a chance to turn someone on to something they may not have heard before.
I love this track, Ethel Me Plough Queenie, and I was surprised to find it is on Spotify, so it's such a great track. It's a swear word, so they're really visceral. You want to sing along and swear with them. Fucking bitch, cunt, fucking death, Queenie, death. I first heard it, the dance version at Heaven, And I didn't, I thought, what is this track? It's amazing. And I asked Lee, I told Lee Barry that I heard this track, and he said, well, ring the DJ up. And I said, I can't ring the DJ up to find out what the track is. It was Martin Confusion, the DJ. And so he said, he phoned, got the phone out and dialed the number and said, here he is. And I said, oh, what was that track you played that goes fucking death, fucking... And he told me it's Ethel Meatplow, and I went and bought it, but it's fantastic.
It was hugely influential to Minty as well, actually. It was influential to Useless Man, I'd say, wouldn't you? Would you agree?
Yeah. Especially the visceral quality of swearing. I don't know, forbidden words.
I said that Ethel Meatplow track really reminds me of a time when our society, the underground alternative society, had been ravaged. We'd watched our friends dying horrible deaths in front of us. Mm. Brutal. It was a horrible way to go. And that Dick's track has the energy of that time, very well captured. A roar of fury in the face of losing some of the most brilliant people on the planet. But on a positive note, it's a great track.
Okay, well, that's a perfect place to end this. So if people want to find out about the stuff that you're doing with Minty...
We have an email address, which is mintymusichq@gmail.com. I'll say that again, mintymusichq@gmail.com. I've got a Facebook, Glamour, Matthew Glamour. I have a personal Facebook page. A Spotify, we've got a Spotify artist profile, so the music's going up on there. That's Minty, obviously.
We were lined up to do gigs, Glastonbury.
We had Glastonbury,
Paris.
We had all sorts. Yeah, no, we were on tour, we were about to start touring. And the show was going to be great. It was going to be a big audiovisual show, which we'll still do. I mean, if we live, we'll get through this. We've got to do the last one. We'll get through this one.
Of course.
We'll live. We'll do a show.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
It's lovely to meet you.
It's been an absolute pleasure and an education as well. I've learned so much more about some of the clubs that I never thought I'd know about. And it's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There you go. Minty. Just done a podcast with Minty. I just hope for those that may not have been aware of the works of Minty and the club events that Matthew's done and just the genius that is Lee Barry as well. Just go on YouTube and just absorb as much as you can, because it's incredible, it's weird, it's wonderful, it's just, yeah, just go and get stuck in, because you're gonna like what you see. Okay, we're back next week. Thanks ever so much for listening. And please, if you want to help this podcast, subscribe. If you just subscribe, then each week you get a little episode popping up on your listening device. So thanks again, and I will be back next week. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. PodBibleMag.com.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.